Well, I wanted to do a little review of just some general concepts that will help us kind of frame this whole discussion of transgenderism. Now, one of the foundational elements in kind of modern thought is there's this division between the soul and the body, right? That the body is distinct from the soul. If you want to know who somebody really is, you need to look into their heart, into their soul. And that's really one of the great projects of a modern pilgrimage is to discover who you really are, right? And to be true to you, whatever that may be. And your body doesn't necessarily define that for you, right? You know, the body is just a physical construct. Who you are is who you are immaterially. And so when we look at this applied to transgenderism, right, they make a distinction between the gender and the sex, right? Anybody want to help me out with that? What would be the popular understanding of sex?
Biological.
Yeah, it'd be biological, right? It's, you know, and that would be defined by your anatomy, okay? And then what would your gender be?
It's a construct.
What was that?
It's a construct.
Something. It's a construct, but yeah, let's keep on going.
It's like something that's in your head, basically. Like,
yeah.
You identify with more with this gender.
Yeah.
But your sex is different.
Yeah. So it's a self, it's your self-perception, right? So if you think you're a female and your anatomy is a female, no problem. You're cisgender. But if you think you're a female but your anatomy says male, what does that say? You have gender dysphoria. And the idea is this causes such distress. It's very difficult to live with yourself. And so in the modern movement, right, the attempt is to change your sex. And so you might do that through hormones, through surgery, but it's also very important that society affirms your true identity to kind of reduce gender dysphoria. And so when we've been looking through some of these passages, specifically with head coverings, right, how does head coverings help us to basically push back against the argument that gender and sex should be severed, or it would be, let's say, permissible for you to express yourself as another gender? Leo, you want to give it a shot?
Can you repeat the question again?
I mean, how does, why is the argument of head coverings important in this discussion?
I think we should ask the ladies going through 1 Corinthians.
Well, I mean, the argument of head coverings, okay, basically is this. Men should look like men, and women should look like women. And, should a woman be in a situation where she prays or prophesies publicly, and I think it's really that narrow context, she needs to make it very clear that she still embraces being a woman, all that entails, including being under male authority. Okay, so that's the gist, right? So how that applies today, I mean, when everybody wore togas, head coverings were probably the way to distinguish the genders. But, you know, there's men's fashion and there's female fashion, right? You go into, I don't know, Old Navy. I haven't been in there yet. Anybody been in there?
Okay. I'm wearing it right now.
Love it. Okay, yeah, there you go, right? There's a men's section and a women's section, right? And in fact, it's important to have that because you still have to have two genders to have gender dysphoria. But the idea is men should look like men and women should look like women. That's kind of the broader argument here, okay? And I think somebody who's transgender could tacitly agree with that, right? I agree, men should look like men and women should look like women. But what they do is they kind of change the definition of what a man is and what a woman is. It's basically only related to your gender. The sex has nothing to do with it, okay? So what I want to do with this next passage is kind of explain that your sex does have something to do with it, okay? I'm not sure that We'll do the Leviticus passage, and then we'll kind of back into the 1 Corinthians passage. So we're on page 10. In Leviticus 12, 1 through 3, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, and at the time of her menstruation she shall be unclean. On the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised." Now, this has some interesting implications for a number of reasons. Number one, is it possible for a male who identifies as a female to obey the commands of verse 2? Okay, we're just going to state the obvious. No, why not?
Doesn't have the anatomy.
Does not have the anatomy, right? Men cannot give birth, right? Now, that's why some people will say you can, right? They're birthing persons, but this is where it just gets kind of crazy, okay? It's just a denial of the obvious, okay? And then you look at the second part. Is it possible for a female who identifies as a male to obey the command of verse 3? Why not? Nope, why not? They don't have the anatomy, right? So the Bible doesn't recognize a different... I mean, these are synonyms, right? There's not this hard psychological division between the two. It's a foreign concept to the Bible. It's a very, very modern construct. And to read it back into the Bible is what we call an anachronism, right? It would be like reading self-esteem back into the Bible. That was a concept developed in the 20th century, not the first century. Okay? And so then kind of going back to another passage, 1 Corinthians 6, 9. Do I have anybody who wants to read that? You want to read that for me? Or do you have a question?
I have a question real quick.
Okay, let's hear your question.
So how do we, because I've heard a common response to that. Obviously they're being facetious, but what about women who can't have children? You know, if the capacity for having a child is what defines a woman, you know, what's a kind way to respond to that?
Capacity to have a child defines a woman?
Yeah, so they said, okay, if the capacity, if the, you know, the you having a child, you know, you bearing a child, like in Leviticus 12, 1 through 3, is what defines a woman, then if a woman is sterile, then she's not a woman.
Well, it's not just having a child. There's also menstruation.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's pretty safe to say that all women, given enough time, will menstruate, right? It's based off of the anatomy.
And if they're not, something's wrong. Like there's a...
there's something broken.
An illness or something's not right.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously we account for the fall. And that'll kind of factor into intersex and everything. But by and large, the design... And keep in mind, I mean, one thing about the Christian worldview is that we are created beings who have been given purpose, and that's expressed through how we've been created. Now, when you believe that we're just products of evolution and there's really no soul, no rhyme, no reason, no purpose, then it kind of breaks down to the only person who can give you purpose is you and yourself. Does that make sense? So the idea of creation and being made in the image of God is kind of that is the bedrock foundation of Christian ethics and sexual ethics. Okay, a good question. So let's look at... 1 Corinthians 6, 9. "Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals." Okay, now focus on effeminate and homosexuals. That's basically talking about the active and passive participants in the same-sex act. Okay? So how does God's condemnation of the active and passive participants in the homosexual act help us to understand God's sentiment towards transgenderism?
They're acting contrary to creative design.
Yeah, they're acting contrary to creative design. Okay. I think there's a sense where the passive participant is playing the role of a woman. Therefore, both of them are seen as violating God's commands, right? And this is also kind of a pushback where some people will say, well, it just condemns homosexual rape. Yeah, that's all the Bible, you know, forcing yourself upon you, you know, kind of like what happens in prison and other venues like that. Yeah, it's both the active and the passive ones are done, and because they're violating the natural order, right? That men are to be with women and women are to be men, and that sexual union is the only one that's permissible within the confines of marriage. But the one who's impersonating a woman is also condemned as well. Okay.
Aren't the words used ish and zakar, meaning so it's male and man.
Ish and zakar, those sound, that sounds Hebrew to me.
Yeah,
that's
pretty
that
Greek.
Maybe it's, I'm thinking Old Testament.
Yeah, could be.
I'm thinking Leviticus, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so those are, so while this speaks of same-sex activity and not cross-dressing, it helps us to understand God's moral objection to homosexuality. By refusing to embrace the complementary roles of husband and wife, they have rejected the created order. This is part of the reason why transgenderism is a sister sin to homosexuality. Both reject the created order. Homosexuality rejects the complementary nature of the husband and the wife relationship, and transgender disavows God's prerogative in making humans male and female. Okay, so let's look at another one, H, on page 11. And these are all common sense, right? Matthew 19:4, he answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female?" So, who made men and women male and female? God, right? Now, how does this passage answer the objection, God made a mistake by putting a man in a female body?
God's ways are perfect.
Yeah. Now, some people will say, well, what about the fall? How would you guys answer that? Could God have made a mistake by putting a man in a female body?
I think we should just read the next passage.
Yeah, that's true. But there would be another answer too. Could God have made make a mistake by putting a man in a female body?
I mean, your premise there is that God's making mistakes.
Okay.
And the fall, you know, that it's not necessarily at a creational, you know, soul-body connection level. And so that's not something that can be corrupted by the fall in that sense. You can't misplace your spirit in the wrong body. That's not how the fall works.
Mm-hmm.
The fall corrupts what is already there.
Now, there's something that's kind of happening here, right? There's this assumption that you can have a man and a female body, like the two are separate. It's almost like saying, can God make a rock so heavy that it can't lift? Right? That would be an absurd premise, absurd question. In the same way, did God make a mistake by putting a man in a female body? That only works if there's a difference between a male soul and a female spirit, right? There is a holistic connection. That idea, that severance between the two, is a completely foreign concept to Scripture. He never made a mistake because you can't put a male in a female body. Does that make sense? So that one very subtly, see the language very subtly assumes something and then uses it to prove a point. Okay, you guys following this? And then kind of go into Psalm 139:13. Volunteer to read that one. Julie, why don't you go ahead.
Psalm 139:13. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb.
Okay. According to this passage, who determines your sex? God does, right? Now, some will raise the following objection. Sex is not as apparent as you may think. For instance, some people are born intersex. They have both male and female genitalia. Now, this is a rare condition, and normally it is obvious which set of genitalia is functional and which one isn't. So why do we have intersex individuals? And for that matter, I mean, why do we have conjoined twins? Yeah, it's because of the fall, right? Something is broken, something's wrong. So why is it problematic for transgenders to appeal to biological reality of intersex individuals to prove their point? Why does that not help their argument?
There's still a chromosomal answer in intersex.
Okay.
As well as they're using a very, very small percentage of...
Yeah.
That's not a choice. You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not a choice. Okay, what else?
It's kind of self-defeating because they're assuming that your biological sex does actually determine who you are.
Yeah. So why are you appealing to a biological reality?
You've rejected that.
That you'd be rejected. Okay. Other thoughts?
This one, like body and soul are still one. Like it's not, there's not a separation there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're basically taking something that's like, so like with an intersex person, they're, it's like there's something missing and there's something flawed, whereas with a transgender person, it's like nothing's missing, nothing's wrong.
Yeah.
You're just, you got...
That's a good distinction, right? There's nothing wrong with your typical transgender person. Nothing is wrong. All the organs are functional, they work, they're healthy. But what's wrong is your self-perception. Was that disjunction? Yeah. Any other thoughts?
You also don't want to make a rule out of an exception.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something, and especially an exception where it's clearly not the way it's supposed to be.
He's also, it reminds me of, I think it's called DID now, multiple personality disorder, where it's like transgenderism and DID are both based on these heavily assumptive premises that have no like actual neurological proof. There's some neurological connection for DID between like memory, you know, like in the brain that's where the like it lights up. But that's it. And so they're both taken as truth. And if you disagree, you're hateful. You're all these things. But they're so keen to make this statement, to hold to this thing as true, that they skipped past a lot of the really necessary first parts. Mm-hmm. And so the entire thing is built off premises that are a tautology. They assume that they are true because they are true.
Yeah.
Right? And so ultimately, that has nothing to do with being intersex.
Mm-hmm.
The intersex, like there's biological, neurological consistency with how that operates and how that works for a person and whether or not they're actually female or male.
Yeah.
Whereas with multiple personality disorder and transgenderism, it's all based off of assumptions that are guaranteed as true, even though there's not actually.
Yeah, there's biological ambiguity in an intersex individual. That's not true in your typical transgender person. That's a completely different issue. And ultimately, if you wanted to, when you have someone whose chromosomes say male, and genitalia say male, but the brain says female, what would be the biological conclusion? Right? So, I mean, that's one of the things that we're talking about here is if we were to just kind of assent to their soul-body distinction, and I think what I'm arguing is, like, God assigns your gender / sex. They're basically synonyms. They're not to be divided. And he's sovereign over that. And what's interesting is God gives different commands for male and female, right? So you can't necessarily be in a marriage and knowing that God has distinct commands for the women and commands for the men, decide that you don't like the commands assigned to your gender, and then change your gender so you don't have to obey them anymore, right? God doesn't make any distinction. If you don't want to circumcise your son, you don't say, well, he's probably a woman, right?
He can have children now.
You can have children, yeah. So there's, yeah, so the Bible just sees no distinction between the soul and the body when it comes to gender. They are integrated. And in fact, I mean, we'll talk more about this a little bit later on, but I'd imagine that when we're going to be resurrected, we're going to be resurrected as male and female. The other thing too is when you say that you are a male, when you're a female, that's a lie. It's just not true. It's reality distortion. It's a rejection of what is plain and obvious. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that's one of the things that kind of like, in this whole journey of self-discovery and everything, to have this construct forced upon you, this gender construct, is very, to in their mind, suffocating, and it stops their own ability to express themselves and discover who they truly are. Every question should be open and out. Does that make sense? So really, transgenderism is the fruit of this soul-body dynamic that's kind of developed. It's the most obvious and absurd expression. And they are, and I think it's led to a lot of collateral damage. You guys ever have any friends who are transgender or interact with transgenders? Yeah. I was paying a bill this past week, and it was really a woman, right? With a beard, you know, took my receipt. And it was kind of very sad, because it was clear what she was trying to do. And you think about what kind of brings somebody to that point where they think dressing, you know, taking hormones to grow a beard is something that would be helpful, right? And for the record, I had the better beard, just so you know. So how does a world minister to transgenders? In their minds, should we change their bodies or change their minds? I mean, what's the world solution to this?
Change the body. World change the body. Next step.
Yeah, change the bodies, yeah. Yeah, why is that the case? Why do they think that's what has to happen?
Because they think what's ever in their brain is more accurate. Mm-hmm. And so they want to match their body to their brain, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, in the neo-postmodernist world, mm-hmm. mental standards are king. Whatever, mm-hmm. whatever you want, you know, you get. Mm-hmm. Whatever you set your mind to, you can do it. You know, it's that we've been fed this steady stream of statements, which is, you know, whatever's on your mind, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
That's the right thing to want. And anybody who says differently, well, they're mm-hmm. just wrong, because it's your brain. And so it's this understanding that mm-hmm. it's almost like a regression and comprehension of mental and possible like neurological issues.
Yeah.
By just assuming that those neurological issues are a healthy and positive part of that individual's life.
Yeah. Yeah, other thoughts? Yeah, I think on one end, right, is you change their body, right? What else do they advocate for change?
Affirmation.
Affirmation. Why would that be so important?
They want to be accepted as mm-hmm. how they identify as. Because mm-hmm. their entire identity in life is wrapped up in, mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah. They want affirmation for their identity. Now, why else do you think that's important? And what would it take to get there? Like, I think, you know, you've truly crossed the threshold where men see trans women as women, when they are just as willing to date and be romantically involved with a trans woman as a woman, right? Isn't that, that's when you really cross the line. But obviously there's differences, right? You know, and you can't just say that he's bigoted because he won't do that. Could be because he wants to have children, right?
No, but that's bigotry. That's heteronormativity. It's fine.
Heteronormativity, yeah. Yeah. So those are just some of the things, like it's really a desire for affirmation. So I think what I want to do right now is I want to kind of like, kind of consider the humanity of these people, okay? And part of the reason why I think, you know, this last presidential election, there was clearly a backlash, right? One of the winning issues was the Kamala Harris advocating transgender surgeries for illegal immigrant prisoners, right? It was like the perfect campaign commercial. And you have transgender athletes playing women's sports, right? That was something, there's a major pushback against it. And so there is a lot of momentum against transgenderism right now, okay? But I think we have to separate the movement from the people. Okay, so these are just some quotes. I got this from World Magazine. And the article is Mascots and Manipulators. And what he's arguing is that there's a difference between people who are pushing the movement and the people themselves who are experiencing this. Okay? So here's a couple of quotes. I guess I have three. I knew a genderqueer couple that required you to use rotating pronouns for them. She, he, she's, his, her. Is that how you say it with the X? I'm kind of using the Chinese pronunciation.
I think it's
right.
Ziz.
Ziz? Is it a Z? Okay.
Ziz. Maybe it was Z, H, and
yeah.
I mean, it's all made up.
Yeah. I just said they or didn't talk to them. And then he goes on to say, most trans people just want to live and not turn everything into a battle. I've been crying all morning. A friend posted a candid picture of me, and all I see is a horrible man I can't escape. This is never, ever going away, even after years and years of hormones. I want to die. Why can't I just disappear? I feel absolutely like I am a woman stuck in a man's body, and I spend a lot of time thinking and reading about transitioning. I occasionally have these insidious doubts. I've had anxiety since childhood and struggled with depression through my teen years. What if these thoughts of being trans are just me trying to escape these problems? Maybe I just want a fresh start, and this is the most extreme way of getting that. Or I want to look like a girl. I never could. My body's an inverted triangle shape. My feet are size 12. People say suicide is never the answer, but I need to know why it's not the answer, because as far as I can see, it is. That, or I get some bolt of inspiration from God. I pray every night. I don't even know who to or what for, because I need something to change. Right? So how can these quotes kind of help set the tone for our conversation as we talk maybe to trans people or talk about trans people?
They're clearly searching for something.
Yeah.
So there's a void there that they're trying to fill with worldly, selfish desires and appeal to that.
Yeah.
And hurting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an easy path, is it? Right, to be at a point where you think injecting yourself with hormones, cross-dressing, getting surgery, and going through that, when you think that's a good idea, I mean, there's clearly something off, right? That's why they're doing it. Yeah, that is their fix. Other thoughts? So
and they're not, sorry,
yeah,
I was just saying, I think it's not like they're, I mean, some of them are, but they're not all just saying, okay, I'm a woman now, and doing that, right? It's it's years of frustration and questioning and feeling like something isn't right, and I can understand that, right? Something isn't right. But when you're told that the thing that's not right is a different thing than the thing that's actually not right, then it can take you to a worse place. And so it's not these, most of these people aren't being careless. They're not being lackadaisical. They're genuinely looking for a solution.
Yeah.
They've just been fed enough lies that their solution is the wrong one.
Yeah. I mean, why is it important to remember that there's a difference between somebody who's dealing with trans issues and somebody who's aggressively advocating for it?
Sometimes person advocating for it isn't even like trying to transition or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes the people who are going after those issues, they're not even involved. They call themselves like an ally or something
mm-hmm.
like that. They're just like advocating that they can do whatever the heck they want,
mm-hmm.
but then don't even address any problems with it. They're just that you have to accept them.
Yeah.
So I feel like a lot of times they're the ones advocating it more for the individuals who are actually
mm-hmm.
going through problems and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, they're just being led by someone else's mental confusion.
Mm-hmm.
They're not being led by even their own.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many like just real conversations actually get.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you know, you get the media kind of portrays that they're just oppressed by everyone that talks to them, and
mm-hmm.
but I wonder like how many actual conversations they have with somebody that
mm-hmm.
would disagree but still care for them.
Yeah. So you look at somebody who's, let's say, an ally, a trans ally. In their mind, they're doing the right thing, right?
Yeah.
Why do they believe that they are doing the right thing? What are they fighting for?
Because they think it'll prevent suicide.
They think it'll prevent suicide? Yeah.
They see this person that's like hurting and they just want to affirm them in something.
Mm-hmm.
They want to just help the person, but they think that that's the right way, even it may not be.
Yeah, so compassion and empathy, those are the dominant virtues, right?
A lot of times it seems like it's also just virtue signaling.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be an advocate here.
Yeah.
For my own attention.
Yeah, virtue signaling is a way of feeling more righteous than other people, right? But there's always some, like even self-righteousness has some like kernel of righteousness that's convincing to enough people to exalt you as righteous if you do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think that's something that we just have to keep in mind. Like this is the, you know, the broader culture war is like compassion, affirmation, empathy, all of that, just giving people permission to express themselves here, right? There really is kind of a worldview issue involved. And they are fighting against people who, let's say, believe in confrontation and conformity, right? Like community, whenever you're part of a community, there's kind of a norming that takes place, right? If you're going to be part of this family, you need to show up with a good attitude at Thanksgiving. Or if you want to be a part of this, you know what I'm saying? If you want to be a part of this, anytime you want to be a part of the society, there are certain like obligations we put on people. And so, yeah, sometimes there is shaming, norming that takes place.
And to some level, the social contract is a great thing.
Yeah.
Right? Shame plays an incredible role in like dealing with crime.
Yeah.
Communities that have great social shame systems set up are actually a lot better at dealing with long-term crime than communities that don't.
That's extremely true.
But when the concept of what we choose to shame becomes a lot more relative.
Yeah.
Right, that's when you start to...
For instance, if I were to go off and commit adultery, flagrant adultery, I would not only lose my job, but I would be shamed. Right? And I should be shamed. Especially if, let's say, it went on for the last 5 years and I kept it hidden as I kept on preaching and ministering. You know what I'm saying? There's like, you should shame me in that case. That's not a bad... So shame's not always a bad thing, right? If somebody steals from somebody or somebody abuses a child, right, we would shame them, right? So it's not a bad thing. So shaming is always kind of conforming and everything. So part of what we're seeing right now is we have like two different approaches to how to deal with these troubled individuals, okay? So here is the question kind of at of the hour, right? Should we use preferred pronouns? You're shaking your head emphatically. Why is that?
Because it just affirms their delusion.
Okay.
It's a lie. It denies what.
It's a lie.
Yeah.
So from the other perspective, right, why would they say you should use preferred pronouns?
It doesn't hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have a negative impact on your life.
Mm-hmm.
It helps them be happier. From a utilitarian standpoint, what's being, you know, there's nothing wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For me, it's say if you do use the pronouns, you're giving them satisfaction for their sin issue, but
mm-hmm.
as followers of Christ, we're also called to be compassionate toward others. As
yeah,
well.
Yeah. Have you guys ever been in a situation where you've been asked to use a different set of pronouns than what he has? How do you negotiate that?
I just avoid their pronouns entirely.
Okay. Talk like Tarzan?
No.
Did they make Tarzan happy?
With pronouns is that they're third person. So you're never going to use someone's pronoun when you're talking to them. You're going to say, you. So the only time it becomes an issue is when you're talking to somebody else about whoever this person is, at which point it's not really, like, they can't get upset if they're not there.
Now, I've read a news story where they use preferred pronouns that were contrary to the name and the gender. I was so confused. It's like, who is this woman they're talking? Right? It's very difficult to, like, even just understand things, right?
And then,
there was just an article in the paper, I think in some position at the university that just switched, probably DEI related, but this person, they were talking in general terms of pronouns, and then all of a sudden, just reading the article, then it's the they, them, their for this individual. It's just like, it just boggles your brain to have to even try and figure out.
Yeah, it's like there's this code.
In the context of the sentence.
Yeah.
And it's just.
It is. Scott, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I've had several experiences like that, several occasions. One thing just I've noticed is that often, as Nathan was saying, it's really in reference where there's multiple people involved where you're using the third person pronoun. And when I use the pronoun of their sex, oftentimes the people around me that are having conversations, they start getting confused because they'll naturally revert to that, and then they'll start correcting themselves, and they'll revert, and they'll correct.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not really sure what to say because they're trying to communicate with me, and I'm signaling this is a male or this is a woman. And then they're also trying to be respectful of, oh, I'm supposed to say...
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, I think they're this now. And it just illustrates again that when you, it seems like,
mm-hmm.
It's just an outpouring of when you reject reality and the truth of reality, you're kind of unattached to any
mm-hmm.
clear perception of what's going on, and you're unable to communicate clearly
yeah.
who
mm-hmm.
that person is and who are we talking about, what are we.
Yeah.
What are we talking about? And so, and mm-hmm. I have had, when you talk about the person versus the allies, I've had students, for example, that I'd say more this way than the other way that have said, yeah, I understand your position, and you know
mm-hmm.
they're more concerned that their friends will want to defend them in
mm-hmm.
class, for example, if I say he and they want to be called she, they're not
mm-hmm.
going to make a big deal of it, but their friends might because they'll think they're being attacked.
Yeah.
There's also always good places.
Oh, hold on a second. Lisa, what were you going to say?
So for me personally, it's like the wrong English, you know?
Uh-huh.
That thing number one is already. So I think if I say something wrong in their case, I can be forgiven just because of that.
Uh-huh.
And second thing, like, I think just remembering their names.
Yeah.
Just saying by the name, I don't have to think like if it's they or he, the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Malachi?
Say, I think having conversations with them is always important. And there can come a point at which they just say, you know, I don't like you calling me that. And I have to kind of stay on. I have to cross that line in the sand.
Yeah.
And I have to say, well, I respect you as a person, but I can't do that. But I've had a lot of conversations where I say, hey, I'd love to use your name.
Okay.
I'd love to use your name. But I think we can both agree that we're just coming at this from two very different angles. And I'm happy to talk with you if you ever want to about where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
But I can't hold to that. And I've had people who've had reacted really, really badly. But I've also had a lot of people who've reacted perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is when we use them, right?
I don't understand why I need to go plural.
So what happens is they'll say, oh, you know, you use them in an everyday context. Them has always been used. But it's always been third person singular as opposed to second or first person singular. And so I don't refer to one individual as them. That's never historically grammatically been consistent, right? It's always been a third person singular address for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so it almost is twisting where we can't even say them anymore in an attempt to be careful of how we address the matter without them saying that we're, you know, see, look, you're using them. Was that so hard?
And I think part of it, like the they, them, is they want to switch to like a non-gendered English language.
Yeah.
And that's a major accommodation, right? It's one thing to have like bathrooms at the Kansas City airport that don't have men's and women's signs, but just giant toilets, and I wash my hands next to some moms. You know, seems kind of wrong. Still does. But changing the language itself, I mean, that's a major, because that's part of the community, right? The common language where we all understand the rules and at least the confusion. But how about this? How about somebody, you meet a man pretending to be a woman. Like, I'm talking to this person that I interacted with on Friday, and she goes by the name Jack. Do I call her Jack?
I think there's more conversation with this because name is chosen later. It's not as tied.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me, some of it depends on how I know him. Like if it's a casual just walking through, you know, at a grocery store or something.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a big of a deal as to like if it's somebody I know that I knew prior to a change.
Okay.
Or,
yeah, you bring up an interesting distinction. Like,
yeah.
If they're a stranger and they say Jack, what else can it call them?
Yeah.
If that's not your real name, we'll see your license.
Hey, person.
But
what's your birth certificate?
What does your mom call you?
What's your mom call you?
Well, I think it also means the mom is there.
What's that?
I said the mom. If the mom affirms it, it's still be Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's say your sister wants to go by Rufus.
I call my sister Rufus. Her name's Rufus.
Yeah. Let's say your sister wants to take on a male name. Do you do it?
Because we have a very specific role to speak truth into, you know, into my sister's life in a way that I wouldn't in a stranger's. I have a duty to my sister in a special way that I might not have in quite the same way to somebody who I've come across in the market.
Okay. But if your sister wants to go by her middle name?
Elizabeth.
Yeah. Do you call her by her middle name?
I feel like it depends on
still
the
actual name.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it depends on the middle name because I knew a guy and his middle name was Paige, so I feel like if it's
androgynous.
That's
an
interchangeable.
Yeah.
So my sister's name is Caitlin, and when she was in elementary school, there was another Caitlin who her last name also started with a G, and they spelled it the exact same, and so my sister started going by Katie. Just to like keep it, you know, easy to tell apart. And so for a while, she went by Katie like completely at school and stuff. And you know, everybody knew that her name was Caitlin, but they just called her Katie. And I switched back and forth between Katie and Caitlin. Granted, even when I was little, I called her Katie Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's an experience with that.
Yeah.
Where, like even when I'm, you know, with her friends or something, who have basically only known her as Katie, I still call her Caitlin.
Yeah.
Because that's just who I've known her as.
Okay. So with family members, there's kind of like a history. We're going to say something again.
Yeah. I think with what you're called, your name is also somewhat up to your family and the community you grow up in. It's my brother, his name is Chris. We all know him as Chris. Legally, his first name is David. But so is my dad's. So to prevent confusion, we call him by his middle name.
Yeah.
Now, when, and then the confusion starts when he goes to work and everyone refers to him as David, and I'm looking for Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, when people go by their middle names, it's like, wait, that's not your first name? It's almost like a betrayal, right?
You lied to me.
Yeah, somebody have their hand raised. Yeah, so, yeah,
yeah,
go
I was
ahead,
just
Scott.
Gonna say sometimes we get too hung up on names, we're fighting kind of on the wrong hill, because we're really trying to establish that, you know, God created male and female in His image, and that sex is something that's part of God's creation. But names are subjective; they can be changed all the time.
Yeah,
people change their name for a variety of reasons, and so. It's something where it may come up in your conversation, and each case could be different, but it's not really your goal. It's to make sure that you're calling him by a male name or a female name. It's more, that's part of your whole strategy of trying to get it.
So let's say you meet somebody that is a male, but says, call me Jenna. Because it's interesting, we're kind of making this distinction, like when you have like an established member of the community, right? It's kind of a community definition, right? So that's why we're not comfortable with somebody who's part of the community. Like your sister going by a different name is like, no, we're not going to do that. Now, if somebody you don't know, what else can you call them? And then you kind of have like, you know, that's like people who are clearly outside your community. And then you kind of have like the fringe, right? Like, Scott's in a situation where if they change the name halfway through the semester, I mean, what should Scott do? Goes from Jack to Jenna. I mean, what would you do, Scott? Would you call him by a different name, or would you stick with the first name that they gave you?
I with all my kids I've gone, I always ask them at the beginning, what is the name that you like to go by? So sometimes Christopher is Chris, and sometimes it's whatever, so I'll change my name or whatever, but I would still use the same pronouns.
Okay.
Which again, it's kind of a,
can
be confusing.
Yeah.
I think another thing that comes up too is that, and I don't know how much of this is a reality, but like the opposite of your situation where once in a while I have a kid that really looks like the other gender through either whatever procedure, and you don't know right away. And so they start out to you, and you think they're a boy or girl, and through some other means, a report or some kind of demographic information. Oh, so again, I might have to change the pronouns that I was using, even though I'm still using that.
Yeah.
So it's it can be a very confusing.
Yeah.
And again, the point is, again, that you're trying to balance opposing the lie and loving this person for the gospel and planting seeds of the gospel in their life while saying, you know, you're wrong, this is wrong, that's not true, but I still love you as a person, and there's hope for you just as there is for me, so.
Yeah, and then you kind of get to an issue like whose pronouns do you use if you just meet somebody and you're pretty sure it's a male pretending to be a female.
Mm-hmm. You guess.
You know what I'm saying? And
it's like guessing someone's pregnant. Oh, you're not pregnant.
I had a situation where
you just leave.
When's
no
the baby due? She's 3 months old. That's the last time you're gonna ever come to this church. We want to be on the side of truth, but we have to use the information that's given to us.
That's kind of helps us understand that even more, like the head coverings. It's helpful for the community to try and communicate clearly that you're a man or a woman.
It matters to God.
It helps them know, it helps everyone know how to treat you, how to interact with you, who you know it's part of the person that God made you.
Yeah, and even some informal rules like women and children first.
right? And recognizing that the job of men is to use their strength to protect women. You know what I'm saying? Even that's just part of cohesive community to kind of pull together. So next week, we're going to talk more about how the church administer to transgenders. Look at some common objections. But let me pray and I'll let you guys go. Well, Father, I do pray for our church that we will have a heart to minister to those people who are just very confused about their identity and how they perceive themselves. Help us to be able to engage this world with compassion and conviction. In Christ's name, amen.